WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
She subconsciously mocks that lineage, but she's
so that's happening. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
So this is downtown Piermont.
Nice. It looks like I'll be able to get a fancy coffee here.
Yes. Is that something you would like?
Yes, I think it is.
The sidewalk bistro looks
welcome
like
to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this summer, The New Yorker's Nick Paumgarten met up with one of his heroes in music, the singer and songwriter Nick Lowe.
Hi, Mr. Lowe.
Hello, how are you? I'm well, thank you.
Yeah? Playing in the area?
Yeah.
Where?
I'm afraid that information is top secret.
Oh, God.
I
Lowe made it big as a pioneer of what the English called pub rock, and we usually call something like power pop.
Oh, I can't take another heartache, though you say you're my friend, but I'm at my wit's end. You say your love is bona fide, but that don't coincide with the things that you do.
Nick Lowe and Nick Paumgarten met a few years ago, and they went shopping for eyeglasses for some reason. Lowe wears these big, thick, heavy black frames that are sort of his signature. Paumgarten decided to catch up with Nick Lowe again.
Nick Lowe is this tall, blonde, geeky guy with glasses. Except he's not blonde. He's got this great shock of white hair. And he's not really geeky either. He's actually about as cool as they come. The Jesus of cool, they call him, after an album of his from 1978.
Save a bit of power. You got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower.
Earlier this summer, Nick was staying near a town called Piermont on the Hudson River. He was playing some gigs nearby. One morning, he and I went for a walk around town.
Just before I came away.
A few weeks before, he had lost one of his dearest friends and co-conspirators, his longtime producer, Neil Brockbank. And he was pretty broken up about it.
This was Neil. Neil Brockbank.
Oh, yes.
Thank you for knowing, mate. He was way more than a friend, really. He was a sort of, he worked for me for years, and we collaborated. He used to produce my records. He also used to tell me if something I did was completely shit. And well, he died unexpectedly and really threw me for quite a loop. there was a sort of a, there was a trio of, it was me, a fellow called Bobby Irwin, and Neil. And now, I'm the only one of those left. The other two are now dead.
And Bobby died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Both of lung cancer. Smoke like chimneys.
I've been interested for a while in how rock and roll artists handle getting older. Some do the Mick Jagger thing. They pretend they're still jumping Jack Flash. Some go the Rod Stewart route. They sing It Had to Be You. But Lowe found a different way to go about it. He started writing and performing these low-key, suave, cheeky little gems, played with poise and panache.
I'm 61 years old now. Lord, I never thought I'd see 30. Though I know this road is still some way to go, I can't help thinking on, will I be beloved and celebrated for my masterly climb? Or just another bum when it comes to checkout time?
The thing was for me to accept the fact that I was getting older, and to actually sort of embrace it and use it as a sort of an advantage instead of trying to hide it or being embarrassed about it, you know. Some of my colleagues and associates have to do that, really, behave like they did when they were young. And I wanted to avoid that rubbish, you know, at all costs. And it sort of worked. It gave us the excuse, you know, to do almost whatever we wanted.
Yes, and when it's time to pay the bill, I'm gonna get my bag and then I will throw it in the first cab in line.
I saw him perform recently at Lincoln Center, and in some ways, he seemed better than ever. But still, this getting older business, the deaths of old friends, it's all caused him to think a little bit more about his father. His dad was an officer in the Royal Air Force.
And when was this? This was after the war?
Yes. Although he joined the Air Force in the 1930s, when it was... I don't think back then there was anything cooler you could have done than be an RAF pilot. It was like being in U2. You know, he himself was from a military family, but his parents really treated him rather badly, actually. They seemed to do their best to avoid seeing him as much as they could. So they were in India. They sent him to boarding school in the UK. And in the holidays, instead of going out to India, like a lot of them did, you know, he used to go and stay with his friend of his parents. He's out on his bike one day. He was about 14 or 15, I think. And he saw a plane in the sky. And it landed in a field. And my dad asked the pilot if he could get a job, you know, in the wherever the airfield was that he'd come from, which wasn't very far away. He got a job sweeping up and cleaning out the place. And in return for that, this guy gave my dad flying lessons. And he learned to fly. And as soon as he could, he joined the Air Force. And he always used to say that the Air Force became sort of his family.
I live on a battlefield, surrounded by the ruins of the love we built, and then destroyed between us. The smoke has cleared. As I stumble through the rubble, I'm a dazed, seeing double, and I'm truly mystified. My new home is a shell hole.
I gather your father didn't know what to make of the music you were making or the music you were into. He wasn't. He's from.
No, he didn't. He didn't really get it. You know, he was sort of disappointed. You know, my mum was my big champion. You know, she sort of taught me how to play the guitar and
she was a musician. Sing. Your mother?
Yeah, she came from a show business family. In fact. So she encouraged me like mad, and even when I brought home some of my really terrible records, you know, she made my dad listen to them, poor chap. But the only record I actually saw him put on was when we first got a stereo, and he bought this record which was of trains pulling into the station. I don't think he had a clue what stereo was, but when he heard this record of trains pulling into the station, he put that on, he could
you know, and the train noise would go from one speaker to the other, and he'd say, yes, come over here, you can hear it. But yes, I think this is better over here. Yes. You know, stepping over into the different parts of the... No, no, if you come here, you come here in all its magnificence, you know. Yeah. That cheered him right up.
Not for him, Sergeant Peppers.
Nothing like that.
When did your father die?
It was probably about 12 years ago now, something like that.
And had he come around to what you were doing
point? He had totally got it. And by this time, I suppose I had more actual visible success. When I was on the TV all the time and actually getting records in the charts.
Late 70s, 80s.
Yeah, he didn't really like that stuff very much. He liked the later stuff much more. Yes, it was rather sad. When he was dying in hospital, I went to see him, and he had this RAF moustache all his life, even from the very early pictures of him. He had this handlebar moustache, you know. Sort of cliche in a way, you know, except he had one in the 1930s.
Right.
And I came to see him shortly before he died, and someone had shaved half of it off. They'd obviously come around to shave him.
Yeah.
And their hand had slipped or something like that, and they go, oh dear, but they just left him with half a moustache. It was very, very sad and poignant moment. Yeah. He didn't know anything about it, but I thought, oh man, this is
the indignity.
This is very, very bad.
Yeah.
Very bad form indeed.
You didn't have to tell him.
No, I didn't tell him. Yes, he saw me. For a man, he always thought that the greatest pop record ever made was Limbo Rock by Chubby Checker. And he said to me one night when he'd had a few drinks, he said, why would anybody bother with this stuff anymore? It's impossible to beat it, you know. So, you know, the majesty of Bridge Over Troubled Waters, you know, moved him not, you know. Imagine, could have been anything, you know. Limbo Rock, Chubby Checker. Every limbo boy and girl all around the limbo world. The military world, you know, felt totally natural to me. You know, I've never recoiled in horror from all that marching. You know, I used to think, oh, well, this all makes sense, you know, because I was raised in it. And I would have liked to have been in the Air Force as well. You know, I would have been a pilot. I would have loved it. But I wasn't nearly bright enough to tackle the maths and all the other stuff, and to apply myself. And in any case, by that time, rock and roll had come along, and I was, you know, its willing slave.
But it wasn't so much rebellion for you as it was just following a life that interested you.
Yes.
And that would have you, a life that would have
and
you.
And a life that would have me. How well put. Yes, yeah. It was a life that would have me, exactly.
In my life, I've done things I'm not proud of, and too often watched my dreams turn to sand. But it looks like I might have turned a corner. You make me want to be
Nick Lowe, along with The New Yorker's Nick Paumgarten. I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. And in a minute, a look back at summer jobs, good, bad, and awful. Mostly awful. That's just ahead.
Built by my own hand. I pray at last I found salvation. You make me want to be a better man.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the magazine, we've often asked writers to tell us about their most memorable experiences and jobs. You know the kind I mean. Not the jobs that you put on your resume on the gliding career path to success, but the ones that you're still telling stories about 10, 20, or 50 years later. We're going to share three of those stories with you today. First off, Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl and many other books.
My parents were a very budget-minded couple, so I did not have a lot of extra spending money, so a job was always in the picture. And I went through a whole series of jobs in my high school years. I first tried being a shop girl, which was absolutely, completely pathetic because I was pathologically shy. So I never really talked to people. I would kind of hover near them, which everyone loves to have when they're trying on clothes and feeling vulnerable as some idiot nearby silently smiling and shrugging their shoulders. So I got fired from that one. That's the only job I've ever been fired from for cause. And I, for years, would hire on at Honey Baked Ham, especially when they had their big holiday rushes. And so my job was basically a ham display girl. I was like the Vanna White of ham. So all these jobs, I feel like, kind of prepared me to take on the most perfectly 80s job ever, which was to sell frozen yogurt at a mall by my house. And it being the 80s, it was a very Fast Times at Ridgemont High kind of moment. It was very cool to be in the center of this mall. Frozen yogurt was blowing people's minds. They were like, it's frozen, but it's yogurt. And you can get it in a waffle cone or a cup of different sizes. They were going nuts. You know, are you telling me Reese's Pieces can be put on this? What? Months into it, I arrived at work one morning and my manager asked to see me in back. And this already felt very ominous, and when I went into this back room, I could see behind him in the dark some sort of giant white orb and then a pair of long, slender, wrinkled slacks. And my first thought was, my God, I think he's killed someone. Am I going to be an accessory to murder? I'm going to have to, like, this is such a bummer. I did not sign up for this. But it turned out it was actually much worse than that. It was an actual yogurt costume he had bought at some sort of flea market. It was clearly used. And that he wanted me to put it on. He thought I would be perfect for this job because every girl at 16 dreams of wandering around a mall dressed as a formal dairy product. So on went the giant white orb, which made me incredibly top-heavy. And then I put on these strange crumpled black pants, which turned out to be a tuxedo. And I've always wondered, ever since that moment, why the tuxedo? Like, where did the yogurt think he was going? Was it prom? But he seemed too old for prom. It was like, well, maybe was it a wedding? Was he jilted at the altar and now he's doomed to wander the mall forever looking for his runaway bride and killing young girls on their way to get their ears pierced at Claire's Accessories? It's what he looked like because he had a very grim face. There was no smile. He already looked sort of haunting. And as I started wandering around the mall, I only made it more disturbing because, you know, again, I didn't want to talk or interact with anyone. So I just kind of floated in this top-heavy, directionless way, carrying a tray of yogurt samples, which no one dared come near me to get. Inside the giant yogurt head was a mini fan that I was very concerned about because it was whirling dangerously close to my beautiful, fantastic Sam spiral perm. So I did my loop around the mall, dumped all my samples into a nearby trash can, and went to report back to the yogurt store. And I was very close to safety. I was almost there when I kind of felt this tug. And this heard this grinding whir and the smell of Aussie hair spray combined with smoke. And I realized that the mini fan had gotten hold of some tendrils of my fantastic Sam's spiral perm and had caught it up in the motor. I couldn't get it off my head. And I kind of panicked and I had to decide, you know, perm or freedom. And I went for freedom and just yanked that thing off. Left some perm behind. But as I looked in the mirror, I realized that it was nothing, a ton of hair gel and a very carefully placed scrunchie wouldn't fix. And luckily I had a lot of both of those. But the moral of the story for me is to this day, I am always kind to people dressed as food.
Gillian Flynn is the author of The Grown Up, Gone Girl, and other books. In the last few years, Akhil Sharma has published quite a few short stories and essays in The New Yorker. His novels include Family Life and An Obedient Father, which won a Penn Hemingway Award. So we should all be thankful that his original plan didn't quite work out.
I am a deeply lazy man who is also incredibly greedy. I went to law school, and somebody told me that while lawyers make good money, investment bankers make even more money. And everybody was applying for these jobs because everybody had the same attitude. It was wretched in many ways. There were the very, very, very nice investment banks, you know, the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys. And they would have their interviews in at the Charles Hotel, which was a fancy hotel in Cambridge. And then the less prosperous ones would have their events at the Sheraton Commander. which at least back then was sort of decrepit. And we would line up in the hallways of the Sheraton Commander, because those of us who were not especially good applied for everything, because why not? And so we would line up in the Sheraton Commander holding our little resumes, waiting to go in for interviews. And even among a group of people who were unqualified, I felt that I was especially unqualified. I knew nothing about math. I had no background with suggested finance. I wasn't even sure what exactly finance was, what exactly investment bankers did. And I would arrive in these interviews and they would ask me things like, what would you do in this situation or that situation? And the only phrase that I really knew was discount cash flow. So I would offer that up for everything. And at some point they said to me, okay, other than that, how else can you value a company? And then I just became quiet. You know, I knew right away that there was no reason to hire me. And so I thought the only way that they would hire me was if I could tell a convincing story. And so these guys looked at me. They saw that I was a brown guy, an Indian. And they were very open to the stories of me being an immigrant. And at some point, I decided to start lying. I began telling stories about working at a 7-Eleven, about working at gas stations. And then, because I was telling these stories, and these didn't seem pitiful enough, I also claimed that I worked at a 7-Eleven and a gas station at night. I was always something of a writer, and so I enjoyed making up these details. The kids who would come in Saturday night and begin stealing candy and comic books and bags of potato chips, or leaving in the morning when my shift was over and smelling like hot dogs. The alcoholics who would show up at 2 a.m. to buy beer, or the fat blonde prostitute who would come out and hang out at the gas station. They loved this stuff. They were great stories because they weren't true. Look, I grew up with nice middle-class parents in Edison, New Jersey. You know, I did not grow up in great deprivation. I was playing right along with their expectations, which frankly, I did not mind, you know? Like, hey man, if you are willing to see me in this ridiculous way, then I'm happy to take advantage of that. And so they, you know, so I would keep moving on to do these interviews. And usually the people who have no patience for stories are the people who actually do the work. So the associates and the junior VPs, because they're the poor schnooks who are up there late at night, you know, making sure that everything in the Excel model is working. And almost always they were the guys who would ding me, who would say, look, come on, this guy knows nothing. He would be terrible. We can't have him around. What is he going to do? He's going to sit around and tell stories. And I finally did an interview with somebody. I think the junior VP I was supposed to interview with was called into a meeting, and so he couldn't interview me. And I knew right then that I was going to get the job. And a couple of days later, I got a job offer, and I accepted on the spot. Because my thinking was these people could come to their senses. So I said, yes, I'll take it. And the guy seemed quite surprised because I wasn't trying to negotiate. I wasn't trying to, you know, I didn't even say, hey, I'd love to work for you. I just said, I'll take it. And then, of course, the next thing I asked was, when do I get my signing bonus?
Former investment banker and novelist, Akhil Sharma.
I remember later on when I was a banker, I was great with clients because it was the same thing. You know, the shtick I could handle, the actual work was a bit beyond me.
Sharma is a professor of creative writing at Rutgers University, and you can find everything he's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. I'm David Remnick, and you've been listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and we're going to close up now with just one more job story about the shortest job that Alison Bechdel ever had. Bechdel is a cartoonist, the author of Fun Home and Are You My Mother? Here she is.
It was 1984. I was living in Brooklyn, and one
lovely spring evening, my girlfriend and I went for a walk, and we were walking down one of those long downhill streets in Brooklyn, down from the park. And, you know, we were young lesbians in New York City in the early 80s, and we were dressed as such. We were, I'm sure, both wearing Levi's. My girlfriend probably had her denim jacket on. I had very short hair. She had short hair on top and long hair in the back, as people did in those days sometimes. And all of a sudden, this guy on one of the brownstone stoops called out to us. And he said, "Hey, you fellas want to make $5?" So we walked over, and as soon as we got close, he could see that we were not two boys, as he had thought, but two adult women. But he was sort of taken aback, but he didn't flinch. He said, I need someone to carry this desk up to the third floor. And we were both pretty burly. I was in training for my black belt exam then, and my partner had just gotten back from Nicaragua, where she was helping the Sandinistas bring in the coffee harvest. So sure, we could carry this desk upstairs. So we picked it up, and there we went. As we were carrying this heavy desk up the stairs, I remember feeling this great sense of freedom. You know, that something about passing for boys made me feel like safe and powerful. You know, as a woman walking down the street, you're always kind of you're very vulnerable. So this was a cool sensation of having this kind of mobility in the world that was really thrilling. When I tell this story now, it makes me think of my mother. The kind of things that my girlfriend and I were doing, those were not things women in my mother's generation did. And my mother would always say to me, you know, when I was young, I had three options. I could be a teacher, I could be a nurse, or I could go downtown and work at the Sylvania factory. Those were the only options for women to work. So we carried it all the way up to the top floor of this brownstone, up three flights of stairs with this heavy desk as the guy sort of nervously trailed along behind us. And at the top, we set it down and he pulled out his wallet and gave us $5. And we walked downstairs, kind of rolling our eyes, very pleased with ourselves, and took the money and got ice cream cones with it.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Jessica Henderson and Sarah Sandbach. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.